My name is Dave Peterson. I'm a research scientist for the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station, and my lab is kind of right next door here in Wenatchee, Washington. So I've been here for about 15 years now, and over that time I've had an opportunity to study a lot of fires around the Lake Chelan Basin, starting with the Deer Point Fire in 2002 and Hot Peak in 2004, and they just seem to keep coming. And so it's kind of a real pleasure to be able to come here tonight and talk to you about the Wolverine Fire. Like many of you, I was not here at the time, but I was sitting in my office following the InsiWeb updates and looking at the maps and listening to the press releases, seeing, you know, where was it and how was things happening. So tonight's presentation, on Monday night, I talked about sort of what led up to the fire and some basics of fire behavior and fire ecology, but primarily the fire behavior stuff, what sort of stuff influences fire. Before I get going, my daughter's been bugging me for 2 days that I haven't told a joke, so I'm going to try one here. So, I appreciate as the third fire talk of the day that you're all fired up and not burned out. Because my alternative was, you know, why were the deer, the chipmunk, and the squirrel laughing so hard?
Why?
Because the owl was a hoot.
Oh.
All right.
Not bad.
So, if you see Annika, you can tell her I told the joke. So just to review that session from Monday, for those of you who weren't here, we talked a little bit about how fire behavior kind of, we talk about a fire triangle with topography, weather, and fuels being the main things that influence fire behavior. Climate in particular, drought, and different levels of drought that determine fuel moisture, and when we get severe drought, how the effective amount of fuel on the ground increases a lot. Lightning's important as an ignition source, and how important it is depends kind of on whether it comes along with rain or if it's dry lightning. So, in that relationship. And then temperature, humidity is really a big controller of fire weather. So that's kind of how hot does the fuel start out as, how dry does it start out as, and how much energy does the fire have to produce in order to heat the fuel up to the point where it'll combust. And then, you know, how much wind does it generate and all that sort of energy release thing. So the hotter and drier it is, the more energy you get released from the fire and the more capability it has to move. And then we talked about topography, in particular the effect of slope steepness, and that basically on steep slopes, fire can move uphill very quickly because it's sort of preheating fuels as it goes because the flame tips are close to the next thing to be burned. On the other hand, fires starting at the top of a ridge have sort of the opposite problem. They're actually burning where the heat is going away from where the fire is trying to move, and so those tend to move a little slower and be a little less intense. And then we talked a little bit about landscapes and the idea of what does the bigger picture look like and how easy is it for fire to move from point A to point B. And that's a kind of a combination of how much fuel there is, are there big breaks in the landscape, you know, are there big rocky outcrops that with no fuel, is it all continuous, is it steep, is it flat, a lot of stuff like that. Won't go into it all, but also the point that fire severity in one area does affect the neighboring area, so what happens around is important. And then we sort of brought it home to Railroad Creek Valley just prior to 2015, talking about that because of a lack of fire, we had decades of fuel accumulation. The last big fire did sort of at the end of the 19th century sometime, and so you've got, you know, roughly 100 years of time for, you know, things to grow and die and land on the ground. And so a lot of fuel accumulation, a lot of fairly recently dead lodgepole pine that have been kind of crowded out. The climate, we always get these warm, dry summers like today when fuels are predictably drying out. We have the U-shaped glacial valley walls that provide for steep slopes. And the landscape, we have these natural kind of fuel breaks to the north and south being the rocky ridges, and a fairly good fuel break toward Heart Lake there where all those avalanche slopes with deciduous stuff comes down, so there's not a lot of really flammable stuff up valley. But we have obviously a lot of stuff down below us. And the only thing good about that is the prevailing winds tend to go from up valley to down valley. So we have enough fuels and everything so that it could burn pretty much at any time, and it sort of was waiting for the right weather and ignitions and all that. So what happened in 2015? Well, the thing, I guess we'll come back to this, but the thing I want to start you out with is we had a multi-year drought. And our drought up here was not like, if any of you are from California, there was like about a 4 or 5 year drought there that was really, really, really intense. Ours wasn't quite that bad, but you can see all along the eastern slope of the Cascades, we've got that sort of bright red color. And that's, if you look at the legend, that's severe, that's extreme drought. California is in the ultra extreme drought, or whatever they call that, but the super double secret probation. but anyway, so we were, you know, we've got these really dry conditions where the big fuels aren't even fully wetting up in the wintertime. A very low snowpack, things are melting off really early in the spring, a very long potential fire season, and that's sort of a curse. So I think my next slide is going to be the beginning. There may be one more, but what I borrowed, and I really want to give a ton of credit to, in fact, majority of credit for this talk goes to Kari Grover Weir, the Chelan District Ranger, who was kind enough to loan me a slideshow that she had given, and I kind of did some edits and cut out some stuff, and I was glad I cut out some stuff because some of it was stuff that Peg and Chuck covered this morning. But anyway, it's kind of, so there'll be probably about a three to five minute sort of a montage that goes through the sort of the fire to give you kind of an overview of the whole region of 2015, what was going on, not just here, but kind of in all of North Central Washington. And then we'll kind of come back and pick up the Wolverine again. But I think I got it. Let's see. It's probably not gonna be loud enough for you to really hear the music.
All red retires there. Thank you.
that's kind of the automatic part of the slideshow, but just kind of wanted to give you, again, a little bit like what Chuck and Peg presented this morning, but a little more from an outside perspective looking in. I get the music to stop here. Maybe not. Oh well. It ran out in my room. So I guess just to kind of review a couple of the slides that were in there, that this 2015 fire season really was an exceptional fire season, but it also came right on the heels of what we thought at the time was a very exceptional fire season in 2014. And one of my main projects right now is a Carlton fire that burned just northeast of Lake Chelan in the lower Metau. And you know, at the time it was the largest wildfire in the state, at least in recorded state history, at 250,000 acres. And then in 2015 we broke it with at least two and maybe three other fires. So I mean, kind of an idea of, you know, it was really, you know, just that this was not just a short-term event. This was kind of and then just the perspective. I don't know if you could pay attention to all those dates that were going by, but you know, that June 29th, this one and a half day fire in Wenatchee, but it was pretty devastating in terms of from a social perspective. And it's the same day that Wolverine ignited up here, and so you've got this, you know, these sorts of things. And then there's just one fire after another, these ones in Chelan, you know, that are really close to where people are living and vacationing. You've got others that are a little further out, but basically it was just a really a big year for fire. Again, I think the biggest thing you want in terms of causes is really, I mean, there's a pre-existing condition, but it's like the real thing was this severe drought that just meant that anything that got a good toehold was basically going to be kind of a problem. And not just drought, but really hot summer temperatures with wind. I guess that those would be the things. So just to kind of review, this Wolverine started on June 29th with this lightning strike out there overlooking maybe about a third of the way from Lucerne to Stehekin. Anyway, on the Stehekin side of the Railroad Creek Valley and one or two valleys over in Wolverine Creek. Started as a little, you know, 1 acre thing. Person across the hall from me got sent out on this fire early. But when the Forest Service evaluated this fire, I mean, when, you know, whenever a fire breaks out, and the first thing happens is, you know, usually some group of repellers or somebody are going to go in and try to put it out or assess it at least. But you know, when you start looking at, you know, what are the things that need to go into this decision process, and this is one of the things I really like about Kari's slideshow, is kind of taking us through a little bit of what does a ranger or a fire management officer, you know, or an incident commander kind of have to think about. And so one of the things you have to think about is, what are the values at risk besides forest? And in this case, we've got a whole bunch of them. We've got Holden Village with a, you know, 50-year history here nearby. You've got $500 million invested in a remediation project here with a bunch of people, you know, with a whole lot of people in place working. So a lot of human lives at risk. We've got the Dom Key Lake Resort, Lucerne Guard Station, Forest Service property, the Lake Chelan Boat Club with a bunch of very historic old cabins down there. And, you know, some other private cabins. Anything that happens here inevitably affects Stehekin and Chelan and the broader area in some way. So lots of values at risk. So this initial response was four repellers and a heavy helicopter. So you know, there's the smoke. Let's go. Let's send some people in to look and see what's going on. Let's start dumping some water on it. See what we can do. And but then this risk management decision comes into play, where it's made to extract those repellers. You know, after the fire kind of like is starting to get a foothold or not, the water's not all that effective. So let's get those folks out of harm's way. And we don't want to commit, you know, whole brigades of folks in there, because that is a really steep, rugged terrain. I mean, you know, it's like sticking people on the side of Martin Ridge here and expecting them to, you know, move around safely and accomplish something. Very difficult. And like I said, they had looked and seen that the water wasn't being all that effective. So the decision was made not to use you know, not to just keep throwing helicopters at it, and instead kind of pull back a little bit and look for ways, you know, places on that landscape that we've talked about, where are the places that are the most defensible so we can still meet our management objectives of trying to protect these values at risk, but not at the cost of human life or putting firefighters in unnecessary harm's way. And so that's what they're doing with these looking at management action points. Where and under what circumstances can we attack this fire, either with water or fire or something? And you know, for 30 days, it sits out there doing not a whole lot. you know, it grew some, but you know, at the end of 30 days, it's about 250 acres. So, you know, not exactly a steamroller. Then from June 29th to, so that's this is June 29th to July 26th period. We've got this incident management, type 3 incident management team. They're doing some prep work. And actually, Nancy, do you want to talk about, I think this is the point where you guys were wrapping buildings and practicing evacuation stuff, right?
We didn't wrap buildings after the total three evacuation, but we did practice the evacuation.
Okay.
And prior to the in that time period.
Okay. All right, so that's this part here, developing and practicing the Holden Village and Holden Mine remediation evacuation plan, knowing that it's going to involve this combination of bus and boat, so got to get people, you know, you're actually, in evacuating the village, you're taking people toward the fire, so you can't wait till the very last second, because otherwise you're taking people into harm's way. And then we have this July 27th to 29th where the fire started growing. They recognized it was setting up for a potential big run, but don't know if that's going to actually happen. Hard to see stuff. And so then this is when they ordered this type 2 incident team with a little more expertise, a little more ability to start doing some burnout operations and potentially trying to figure out, okay, now where do we start attacking this thing? But that didn't really... and then I guess this is where the evacuating Holden Village piece came in. And that's what you saw this morning. So here's this little chart shows kind of this growth starting July 30th. We got 950 acres, 2,200 acres, 12,000 acres. You kind of see just going from, you know, it spent a month burning the first 250 acres. And then you're just going to kind of exponentially in terms of size. And this, you know, especially this August 1st date is when things just sort of start sweeping down the lake.
Why did it take that long to grow? Is it a weather thing?
Well, I think probably a combination of the weather wasn't probably that extreme yet. And, you know, you notice where that lightning strike was initially, it was in pretty rocky terrain. And so, you know, again, if it's not, it kind of had, for fires to make those big 12,000 acre runs, they really got to get some momentum behind, some, you know, some heat and wind. And I don't know, anybody want to add in? It was like, my recollection is, I mean, the day it ignited, in end of June, we had really hot weather, but I don't know that it continued. I think we actually had some cooler weather for a while, but you know, some of it, you just, you know, it's got to get to that, through that part of the landscape. I'm guessing it was, I mean, I know that one hillside is just to the northeast of Railroad Creek. Any of you who've been coming up over the years, you know it's that nice even swath of, you know, beautiful forested mountainside. I've always looked at that thing and, oh, that's really cool. But you know, I mean, that's very continuous fuel. And my guess is that it just took that long to get a combination of the bad weather and the fuels. And any of you three want to chime in additional factors or anything?
Well, Coffee Down Lake Wind, that they work down to the lake all the time, and Coffee Down Lake Wind took through all the fuel and Lightning Creek.
Okay, so it came down and then
over time, Coffee Down Lake Wind has swept across that
lightning.
The strange thing was, if you're in the donkey fire at night, fire always kind of lay down, you know, decreasing temperatures and decreasing humidity, but that night of July 31st, was that next year? It is like all that long burn. Oh, that's an effort across such fast and donkey basin.
Okay.
It's a really strange fire. I mean, unusual fire here.
So it kind of catches the train moving time. And then The other thing that we'll kind of see late on a later slide is, once it gets across the switchbacks and stuff, it enters in the old Domke Lake fire, or Domke fire from 2007, I think. And that, so that's an area, I think, that's burned like 8 years earlier. Potentially a lot of, actually, I thought that might actually slow it down, but apparently there was enough fuel on the ground already for it to actually speed it up.
Three structures that were lost on Domke Lake?
Yeah, basically Sid's fishing cabin, or, you know, the resort. But it's very historic buildings that had been there a long time. You know, people have been going up there forever, either flying or hiking in and fishing there and staying in these little cabins. And they made it through the first Domke fire, but they didn't make it through this one.
So all the structures, those three are all the remaining structures that were left on Domke Lake?
Yeah, they're gone. Yeah. Yeah. I do know that because I hiked up there last year.
There's one cabin
in the river.
It's on
the front side of the lake. Oh, okay, I didn't get over there. Is that Sid's as well?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's the part I know. I wasn't aware of that one. Okay.
Most of the structures are burned.
Yeah,
that's great. The one that didn't miraculously.
That's terrific. Okay, good. And I won't kind of go through this, except I did ask Nancy earlier if, and I guess I'll punt it to you now, if there's any, no, I mean, just, I think Chuck and Peg's kind of gave sort of, this morning kind of gave the village-centric view of the fire, and I don't in any way, but I didn't know they were going to do that this morning, until this morning, and so I'd asked, Nancy and Mark were both up here through the duration, and I actually Tressa was up here for pretty close to that time. And so I kind of asked if any of them would want to share their thoughts with you, or and just personal observations that maybe aren't covered in the standard slideshow. I mean, you kind of were here and you were briefly maybe evacuated and then came back. Do you have any thoughts?
So the first day when we evacuated 240 people, that was pretty calm. In fact, the sheriff came up because they always have to be a presence. And they're saying this was the most happy evacuation because we have people drumming, people waving out the windows because it's cold. And then that night, so we had 70 more people to go the next day. That night was when it blew up and went across the switchbacks and over Domke. And we actually listened to Sid on the radio. He was out in the middle of the lake. In his boat, watching the burn. And then the next day, we had to wait till the firefighters said it was okay to go down, and they led us through the burn area of the switchbacks, which were still, you know, it was just still burning a bit. And got the rest of those people out. A number of us were still here, 14 left behind from Holden and the Forest Service Trail crew was here. And then we were helicoptered out that evening because the fire blew up in the old Domke burn area, and it was just very extreme fire behavior and Forest Service, and we thought that's not good. We don't know what's going to happen. So everybody got helicoptered out. And then five of us got helicoptered back in 4 days later. And by that time, they had two hot shot crews here, plus the overhead for them. And we just came in as help support for that and running the village stuff.
Yeah. So you're kind of feeding people and
washing dishes, rolling sheets, spraying water, watering porches.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Dan. And, you know, well, like the last time we had some discussion, so I'm sure that we'll have to answer some questions. So just kind of finish that look. This picture I think you saw this morning, I'm not sure who it is, but obviously it's in both slideshows. And then everybody leaving, the lady. I wanted to show this sort of this rapid growth. this whole idea, when we say blew up, there, I mean, this idea of spotting a mile or two ahead of the fire, and that's what causes, I mean, it causes a lot of danger when things are so flashy. You burn out off, I think this is probably burn out around Lucerne. It's like the barge out there.
Was that dark, or was it just so dark from the smoke?
I'm guessing that's a nice shot.
It was dark enough and smoking in the boats on the lake. You couldn't see more than
20
feet.
Couldn't see. She said it was so dark, even during the day, it was so smoky, you couldn't really see more than 20 feet. Kind of like a dense, like tule fog kind of thing. Here are just some final stats, and then I want to kind of... all told, Wolverine burned about 65,000 acres. We talked about the three structures lost at Dom Key. Really burned all the way from the end of June into early mid-October. Didn't really talk about it, but in the process of it came up the valley. I'll talk a little bit about how that happened. But then it made a run over Wilson Creek, I believe it is, and jumped over into the upper Entiat where it burned through the Tin Pan Fire, which had burned, I think, the same year as Dom Key had. So just on the other side of the ridge in the Entiat, there was a lot more of dead trees, and proceeded to make a run down the Entiat back toward the town of Entiat, probably made about a third of the way down that valley, and then I'll save what stopped it here for a minute. But so that's it was probably at 30 or 40,000 acres when it got to here, but then it kind of kept going for quite a while into October. And in fact, there was a lot of concern that fall that it might jump yet another ridge and hit the area around Lake Wenatchee, and where there's incredible amount of cabins and houses and lots of wood. So there was a lot of effort made at making some fuel breaks there. So this was in Kari's thing I thought was kind of interesting. Because, I mean, you can probably imagine if this was your neighborhood, that either you or your neighbors would be thinking a lot of these sorts of same things.
No.
You know, the first public meeting, I think they said they had on August 2nd, I think it was. And, you know, some of there was a slide that had all the audio. I thought we could just kind of cut that out. But I kept the summary because, you know, it's like, why didn't you just put the thing out? And that's what you're always going to hear. I mean, you're always going to hear that after the, you know, fact, because, you know, a bad thing happened. But it is a risk management thing, and, you know, you're trying to balance, you know, what's the risk to, you know, to natural resources, to property, but you got to put a huge high thing on, you know, what's it going to cost us in people? Most of you would much rather lose your house than a family member, right? And so that's kind of what has to go through. Can we really do we have a reasonable expectation that we can make a big enough difference by putting people in harm's way to make it worth it? I guess would be a way. And then there was community concerns about going all the way to Chelan, although I think there was a little bit of confusion as to what was Wolverine versus what was the, remember that first creek fire actually did burn a number of cabins on Lake Chelan, because that was a separate fire, part of the Chelan complex. But that started much closer to Chelan and burned down to the lakeshore briefly, and then kind of they were able to manage it up and away from the lakeshore and let it sort of burn into the Pot Peak fire. But, you know, smoke concerns during the Chelan has a lot of experience with this in the last decade or so, but it's always an issue. You know, if you live in this area, you hear about, you know, radio ads, oh, you know, yeah, there's some fires, but, you know, where businesses are all open, come enjoy Lake Chelan, because communities really rely on that. You know, they've got a pretty short season, and that's what drives those communities and lets them stay in business. The Holden Mine remediation project, you know, we're spending a whole lot of money every day, and every day it's shut down, that's just, you know, nothing's getting done. You know, we see some stuff that's still not quite done, and maybe would have been done had they been able to keep rolling. And then Holden shut down. Nancy talked about that. The one thing I also want to mention is this moving to Type 1 Schulte team. I think I've got another slide. And again, I'll welcome any any adjustments anybody wants to make on this, but so this type 1 Schulte team, our water cooler talk down at the lab was actually kind of positive about that. We were lucky to get the Schulte team in many ways, because they had a long, Schulte at least, had a long history with Lake Chelan fires. And I'm not sure I can give you the exact fires that he had worked on, but between Rex Creek, Pot Peak, Deer Point, all these ones that have basically burned the shore, I think he'd been involved in two or three of them.
He was on the Donkey Fire, actually, too.
Was he on Donkey as well?
He did in Sally before.
Yeah, so I mean, just there was this, and you know, there was this that team brought in a certain set of expertise, particularly that they knew this area very well, and they knew what would and wouldn't work. That's probably as much as anything else. They had already tried a lot of stuff. And so, you know, they didn't try a lot of front, you know, going right at it, because they knew with this rough terrain and stuff. And so it really was about this fighting fire with fire concept that I think they did really, really well. And in fact, we were kind of admiring that they had the guts to do it at all. And I think as somebody who didn't have as much street cred as Schulte, maybe couldn't have gotten away with it. But, you know, the idea was that after that made that big run into Donkey and started moving up here, you know, they had this idea that, you know, Holden's going to be here for a while, and we want to try to keep the valley somewhat intact. And so what, you know, the way it was described to me and what I could see in the maps is that you've got the main front down there around Dan's camp where it's burned so bad. But they started lighting fires up on the ridgetops ahead of that front and letting them burn down. Remember, we talked about the effective slope, you know, and that burning down is going to be less intense than burning up. And so the idea is if you can sort of burn those fuels coming down ahead of the thing, then the front's just going to kind of, it's not going to be able to make quite as many of those really big runs that generate all that heat. And so they kind of tried to kind of create this sort of wedge-like thing where the fire is coming down and meeting at the valley bottom. And obviously you can imagine that's a very inexact science. And obviously in the case of like Wilson Creek, it either wasn't possible or maybe the timing was off a little bit or the wind picked up at the wrong time or whatever. But when you look at that whole north slope, I think you have to be pretty impressed with how well they managed to do on that. Because you know, it would not have been, you know, had you not done anything, it's entirely conceivable that whole slope could have looked like the Donkey part. There's that much fuel on there, and it was that hot and windy, and you know. But by bringing that fire, we have this one picture here of the hotel with the fire behind it. That's another example of stuff lighting up on Martin Ridge and letting it come down to the village. And then you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but what we were hearing about at least was the idea was there's this. They'd already cleared the fuels around the village, or you know, prepped it for a burnout, and we're waiting for that fire to get kind of as close to it as they dare before they then let light the fire from the village and let those two fires meet somewhere away from the village. But you know, you want to, it's kind of a bit of a game of chicken in a way, because you want to let that backing fire come down as far as you can, because that's the lesser intense. If you light too soon, you're gonna get a big old head fire going really fast and furious. And so, you know, this idea that you kind of wait as long as you dare, and then you know, when it looks like now, kind of, we better not risk anymore. Then you go ahead and light out, and the idea is that the thing should meet somewhere, not here. But anyway, I thought it was really, from a fire management perspective, I think a pretty cool and largely very successful operation. Yeah.
Can I ask, what did you guys see of how that was working when it happened?
Well, like the top picture there shows, it worked really well on the south-facing aspects, so above the Martin's Ridge and that area down there. The north-facing aspects are heavier timbered and cooler and damper, like we talked about last Monday. And so they, like Wilson Creek, they had lit in Wilson Creek and Copper Basin in advance of the main fire getting there, and hadn't been able to significantly burn and come down. So that's with Wilson Creek, the natural fire, they hadn't been able to run out of fuel before the natural fire came underneath it, and then made a run up Wilson Creek, and there's a spot over to the NEAT. So it's like they tried that technique there, but it couldn't the fire to come down and take enough of that heavier timber in advance of the main fire. So I mean, the night, this Wilson Creek blew up the same night that top picture was taken, and nobody's really all that worried about that. Actually, they were worried about Wilson Creek, that had a lot of hands. So that, you know, just the terrain limited what they could do. It's a great strategy, and they were forcing the lighting Martin's Ridge when the conditions weren't optimal for that operation, but they were out of time for the amplifier.
Thanks. Yeah, so that's great. So a couple questions. I think we've already kind of asked that, or I answered that, I guess, the why lighting out those ridges and the burnout. But so Wolverine Fire's finally stopped moving. When it got into it, any guesses as to why or what stopped it in the end hit?
Rain?
Rain? No.
Aliens?
Orchards?
Aliens, no. Orchards,
ran out
no.
of fuel.
Aliens.
Yeah, ran out of fuel is kind of partly it. What it? So after it jumped the. Hello. I'll go advance. What are you gonna do? So after it came over here, see, it went through this fire, but then notice all. If you can see this yellow marking down here. Those are a bunch of fires we had in 2012 and 2014. And if you kind of look at a better map of this, basically the fire came down until it ran into that 2014 fire on the one side of the valley, kept going on the other side of the valley until it ran into the 2012 fire, and that's basically where it held. Now that's not to say the fire just went, oh my God, you know, but that's where burnout operations were really successful. I mean, and they were, you know, the combination of weather, lack of fuels, and the firefighter efforts really stopped it, because they had these, you know, areas that had just recently burned, didn't have a lot of fuel. They were able to create effective fire lines there, and essentially that's where. And we see that all over northern Washington here, north central Washington, where those existing fires either put the fire out by themselves, or they create a really nice place for firefighters to work and actually help put them out.
Are there critical time periods between fires when the fuel is there, maybe not all consumed, and it'll blow up like Donkey did, and then 2012 when enough had rotted that the fuel is still moist and not?
Yeah, until Wolverine, I would have said you need about 15 years before it's really gonna burn through hot again. But Wolverine did it in what, 7 or 8, and I think just you wouldn't normally expect standing snags to be half consumed by fire. Usually, if they're standing up, I mean they're gonna get charred and all that, and maybe the fire will drop them and they'll burn. I mean, if the fire can burn, if it's rotten around the base, they can drop and burn on the ground. But if you look down there, there's all kinds of these char sticks sticking out of the ground. And I hadn't seen very much of that. At Biscuit Fire down in Oregon, I saw a little of that, but those were pretty old snags.
Yeah. For someone who doesn't understand the names of things around here.
Oh, sorry.
And has a difficult time actually sometimes reading the maps that
yeah.
Could you just kind of point to a hole on that map?
Yeah, you bet. That's great. So this here is Railroad Creek Valley. This is Domkey Lake here, Lake Chelan. So you got off the boat here, came up, and Holden would be right about here. And then this is this Wilson Creek where it jumped over, and this is the end hit. It comes all the way back down the town.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you for asking. Anyway, just a couple. So then just, I guess, the aftermath piece. So this is a fire severity map that's generated off of satellite imagery. It's kind of a paired imagery thing where you look at the sort of greenness in a year before the fire, usually the same time of year, and then you take another shot right after the fire, and they do some differencing and figure out. But then it's also, you combine that with looking at the actual post-fire image itself and seeing, I mean, to simplify it, are you seeing white ash? Are you seeing black soot? Are you seeing green foliage? Or what does the satellite see after the fire? And that's kind of an indication. This is burn severity from a soil perspective. So you can have these yellow and orange, particularly those yellow patches, you could have most of the trees dead in those yellow patches and it would still be considered moderate severity, because from a soil perspective, the idea is that the soil hasn't been that badly damaged. It might be black soil instead of white soil or red soil. The red stuff, you can see that Lightning Creek face over there. Definitely big changes there, a lot of heat. And then this north-facing slope along this side of the valley is that other area where it's red. I was a little uncertain when that, having gotten up here and seen some of the pictures that Kari had, I was really like, how can you not call that high severity? Because you looked at that area where it went through the donkey fire and it's like, you know, white. And from a at least looking at it from the road, from a distance, you look and say, well, that's got to be high severity. But the bear teams got out there, they hiked over there, they dug pits in the ground, they did their little infiltration, water infiltration tests, and said, no, there's still stuff alive under there. So I was wrong. So the hazards faced right after the fire were basically a couple. The one thing that was a big concern that first year in particular was this flooding risk. That there was a lot of exposed, very dry, very water repellent soil. We get water repellent soil every August anyway, just because it gets so dry. But when you get fire, it can make some chemical changes that makes it even more so. And so there's this risk that if you get a high intensity rainfall event, that the water's not going to have any time to sink in. It's just going to run right off the top, and that can give you this potential for kind of flooding. And then the other potential is that, or taking out roads if the culverts aren't big enough to let the water through. So these little side creeks that don't look like much, all of a sudden in a big thunderstorm, you know, there's all this water trying to get down at one time, and it can, so that you can have some risks to roads. The other thing is all that water running off the surface can pick up a lot of stuff. It can pick up dirt, it can pick up rocks, it can pick up logs and bring that down with it. And typically from a rehab perspective, when we're worried about flooding and erosion, it's kind of a question of how long is it going to be until there's some kind of vegetation comes back. So even if it's just a bunch of grass or dead, you know, that dies off and covers the soil, at least there's something there to kind of hold it in place. So that's one big, that was a big concern the first year, and we, I think it's, if you've seen the vegetation down there now, you can kind of realize it's probably a little less of a concern now, at least for the time being.
It moved on.
It's moving.
I thought I had all these fixed, but I must have copied the wrong slide.
they have automatic time. It's still stuck to them.
The other thing is these hazard trees. I mean, this idea that and some of you have asked me about this, we have a lot of dead trees out there. We're going to have a lot of dead trees out there for a long time. And that's one we've done some research on. And I mean, essentially what we know we can expect is in the next 10 to 15 years, most of those dead trees are either going to fall over altogether or they're going to break off 20 or 30 feet up and drop their tops on the ground. And then they'll persist for potentially a long time as just kind of a standing stem. But basically the branches are going to come off, the tops are going to come off, and in some cases the whole tree will come down. Yeah.
Are you talking about the trees that are charred, or are you talking about trees that previously that didn't actually get hit by fire but got hit by heat, or
are these anything that was killed by the fire?
Okay.
So these are the dead trees. Yeah, these are the dead trees. And you know, in most cases these are going to be trees that died during the fire, either because they got all their needles scorched and they weren't, you know, from just pure heat, or in some cases the fire actually got up in the canopy and burned them, or burned around the base of them. That's another thing that happens a lot of times. If you get trees that have a lot of wood right around the base, it'll just smolder for hours and hours and cook. Basically, anything that it'll girdle the tree by killing all the live tissue at the base of the tree. So you can have any of those things, and then the other thing that often happens is, we're talking about a little bit at supper, was after the fire, all the bugs move in, right? So the trees that are severely damaged are really at risk of actually dying from bark beetles, because bark beetles can kind of tell that this is kind of a weak tree, and I can get in there and and reproduce, and the trees probably too weak to actually pitch me out or fend me off. And then the dead trees, the wood borers are going to come in the first year, and I've been, it's kind of an eerie sound if you go in like a couple months after a fire's passed through and all these dead trees, and all you hear is crunch, 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 crunch. I mean, it's like a cereal ad, you know, for, you know, stays crunchy even in milk, you know, but crunch, crunch, crunch. And it's just all of these wood borers that are burrowing, they're chewing their way into these trees in order to deposit their eggs, plant some fungi in the inside of the tree, and then, you know, so that the next spring their larvae can come out and eat the fungi and go on. And that's their life cycle, but that first couple of years after fire, you just see a lot of that. Of course, that's when the woodpeckers move in because they want to get at them. So you have this entire food web that starts as a result of this big pulse of dead trees. So that's, you know, that's kind of big, but from a human perspective, you know, we really are concerned about the, you know, the next 20 years and what's there that's going to, and when's it going to fall over, and is there anything going to be anybody in the way? So you've noticed stuff along, you know, the remediation folks were very concerned about that along the road, and so a lot of trees got either cut off or pushed over in order to make sure that we had a safe corridor. And then this year, some additional efforts to actually pull those out of the woods, and if you've seen the large log deck down at Dan's camp, you know, that's kind of a way to get that out of there while it still has some value. You know, those down trees, get them out, pile them up, and hopefully use them for something useful instead of having them just rot in place and turn into fuel for the next fire. Just kind of your choice. And then the longer term question, I guess, is going to be what kind of forest is going to what kind of? Oh yeah. Oh, we didn't mind questions anyway. What kind of forest is going to come back? And well, and I think the next session we'll talk a little bit about what the future likely holds in terms of coming back, and how different plant types are going to are able to kind of recover after fire. And I think the title will probably be something like, you know, after the Wolverine Fire, beginning anew, which is not quite the same as beginning together, but. Beginning, I can't have them figure out how to make that work. But I think I'll stop at this point, and maybe we can have questions or discussions. There's multiple people. Yeah.
So I have a question about the soil and the runoff. So is it acting like compaction? Is that why it would run off? Or is it that it can't get through the ash? Or why would the soils be less absorbent of the rain?
So the question is why would the soils be less absorbent of rain, and why this increased runoff, right? So yeah, a combination of things. Normally, if you've gardened, you know, you put mulch on to hold water. So you have this organic layer on the top of the soil of some level that it does a couple things. One is it intercepts rainfall and absorbs the impact of rain. So a raindrop is going to come down with a certain amount of momentum, and it's, you know, going to kind of splash when it hits. Well, if it hits organic matter, that tends to hold together. Whereas soil is going to tend to sort of splash with the, so there's that piece. There's the actual physical impact of raindrops. There's also the ability of either the, in the case of mulch, it might hold the water itself. It might get wet and hold the water. In this case, or it would, if that organic matter goes down into the soil, the organic matter sort of is a conduit for pulling moisture into the soil. The other thing is when that organic matter burns, in some cases, depending on what kind of forest you're in, it actually volatilizes some chemicals that tend to move down into the soil and precipitate out a couple inches down, and so that can actually be what they call a hydrophobic layer. I don't know to what extent we have that around here, but you know. But then just the dryness of the whole thing. Once you let things dry out, and they tend to, I was talking to some soil scientists last fall who talked about that. Not only does stuff run off, but the soil kind of tends to create these cracks. And so what water comes in either goes straight down these cracks into the dry soil, or it runs off the top. And so that topsoil has a really hard time getting wet. Once it gets wet the first couple times, it'd probably do okay. You know, so that's why after a winter or two, you typically have some things getting better. Or if the plants start growing again and the roots start breaking all that stuff up, you know, the root action's pretty good. But that's why it tends to run off.
Okay.
Can you explain what the different types of fire teams are and what it signifies to send in one versus the other?
Yeah, you know, I one is better than two is better than three.
No, I mean, threes are usually, any you, Tressa, you know better than I do?
Threes are more like the local people with less experience. And then as people have more expertise and more experience, they'll get put onto a type two team, and they would be sent out to help with more complex fires. And then type one are really the top-notch people who are going to be on the fires where maybe there's extreme fire behavior and there's a bunch of resources at risk. And so it's just, it's experience and knowledge.
So anyway, yeah, so it, yeah, that's, I guess that's my understanding. It's basically just, and so the idea is as you go from three to two to one, more experience, more special, in some cases more specialized expertise, and they're more likely to travel long distances and be put. I mean, fire kind of works like a police or military organization in the sense that they have sort of a command and control structure, and they're able to, you know, there's a lot of cooperation among the different, you know, different countries, different federal agencies, different state and federal. I mean, all these different agencies, they hire firefighters, right? But they have to kind of, they have to all kind of work in coordination with each other. And so they create these kinds of teams, and then they have a command structure that can kind of try to assign them where they can be best used. But if you get to a type one team, you know you've got an incident. Yeah.
You know, as I walk around Holden, I see a lot of trees that are very close to buildings. And I wonder if anybody's ever taken into consideration NFPA 1141, which is the Urban Wildfire Interface Standard.
Yeah.
And there's also another program called FireWise.
Right.
And are you familiar with that? Has that ever been considered here? Because what I, and I also see these vents out here, these gable vents. And one of the two big causes of fires are trees that are right next to a building, and also embers that go into those vents. There's no way of mitigating that now.
Yeah, I mean we've got certainly, yeah. The village is not going to meet a FireWise standard like you would have in a suburban neighborhood or anything like that. I mean, we have historic buildings that, you know, and limited budgets and stuff. I think the idea is to really keep the fire from getting here, and you know, in this case, you know, we got through one by basically trying to keep the fire from ever. But yes, if the fire burned up to the edge of the village, we'd probably lose a few buildings.
Well, I spent a lot of time crawling around doing forensics in California and all of the big fires down there.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that this is an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I love trees more than as much as anybody in this room. I'm a bird watcher.
Yeah.
I love it all. But if it came to, you know, preserving a village versus, you know, taking some trees down and being creative about what you do with the stumps so that they're not, I mean, make statues out of them or something.
Well, and a lot of that has been done.
Trees hold water,
yeah.
Which is also a threat to a building.
I mean, a lot of that has been done, and you know, some trees are worse than others. I mean, a lot of these cottonwoods are actually probably helpful in general.
I can comment on that a little bit, too. We do our Florida standards. We've done a lot over the years
Yeah.
It used to be a lot more prepared against the village, but there's a lot of competing demands on this area because there's wetlands along back here and over here that there are restrictions. We're on, you know, there's the historic nature and historic of the village we have we're required to take into consideration as well. So it's sort of this compromise between fire and other priorities, which are historic and wetlands and that kind of stuff too. So the vents were covered in the fire, but they had a building wrapped over all the vents and are under skirting. We're aware of those things. It's often hard to compromise.
I understand your point of view. One thing you might do is look at some of Jack Cohen's videos from, he's a fire researcher in Montana. And if you look at the effect of having trees by the building, it's quite sobering. So just an idea.
Yeah.
So on the Winston Creek Trail, there are these little, it looks like fire pits. Huh.
All along,
little craters with burned logs in them.
Yeah.
And bundles of sticks.
And bundles of sticks. And
was that part of
it?
Where's that now?
On Winston.
Oh, those are, so after the, that was actually a fire line here, the Lorraine Fire, they held that. So actually last year, what they did is they cleared a bunch of where they were going to do the burning operations, took that fuel back to the green side of the fire line and burned out from there. So last year took it from the green side, put it on the burn side, and those would be installed by Forest Service fire crews to get rid of that fuel. So that's a leftover from the fire line, so we're still processing.
Glad you knew that one.
There's a railroad creek trail that goes to the Copper Basin. But then it used to go all the way down to Donkey. Now it's closed.
Right.
Is that an example of something that will just be closed for a long time because there's trees falling and talking about issues? Or is this a sensitive issue?
you want me to answer that?
I'll answer this one. By the way, my name is Tressa. Sure.
Introduce yourself. Then people.
My name is Tressa. I am the Wilderness and Trails Lead for the Chelan River District. So if you're unhappy about any of the trails in the area, I'm the person to complain about too. So.
On the other hand, I think before you answer, I'd really like us to give Tressa a hand because she and her crew have restored an awful lot of these trails. And I mean, a lot of these are really beautiful, and they were not beautiful right after the fire. And so I think we got to give Tressa and her folks a lot of
anyone that wants to go there may go there. The trail probably will not see maintenance again. I may be wrong. Someday we may have the funding and the ability to build a new trail there, but at this point there would be essentially nothing left of the old trail. So that area is open to use. It would be very unpleasant to attempt to hike down it. But we're just managing our budget and our resources, and that's not a high priority for us.
Again, we talked about tree hazards, but there's also that erosion hazard makes a big deal. I mean, sometimes those trails are nothing more than packed down organic matter, and so that burns off and there's no trail left. Or sometimes there is a mineral bed under there, but then the slope above it erodes and fills in that trail cut, and so then there's nothing but slope left. In other cases, there's just so many trees come down that, you know, it would take you a month with chainsaws in order, a big crew to get through it. So, I like that trail too, but I understand.
Does the U.S. Forest Service's future modeling, take into account global warming?
Yes. Often. It's actually been part of planning. I mean, I know that the Okanagan Wenatchee, our local national forest, has been for the last 10, 12 years trying to incorporate that into their forest plan revision. And so that's their long-term planning document. It's through court decisions and stuff. I don't know if you always have to include it, but you often have to at least include some consideration of climate change in major activities that you're going to do. And I think it comes in a lot of times either as a stressor or as a potentially compounding, you know, so if you're going to make an impact, you have to say, well, what's that going to be if you get that impact plus climate change? So they're at least considering it, and there's certainly been a lot of modeling of what might happen as a result, but,
So I know the village put a fair amount of effort into putting a sprinkler system in prior to this fire.
Right.
Has there been any evaluation in terms of what benefit that may have provided? Because that was the purpose, was to defend the village from fire when they put it in. What's the evaluation?
Mark, you want to? Right?
Sure.
I can give you a thought.
So I'm Mark, by the operations manager of the village. And sort of anecdotally, the sprinkler system was actually used partially in a way that we didn't expect or plan for, which is actually kind of one of the great things we learned. We were just running around the perimeter of the building, we ran full circle, and the hotshot crews actually asked us to not do that because they couldn't get their backfires lit. And they wanted to burn out the fine fuels. So what we did is we just turned on the interior of the village, kept that wet and humid. It's a dramatic difference. We were in the village when the sprinklers were running, and you walk out of the village, way hotter and way more dry out of the village. But what they did is that part of the problem they faced down the valley with all the up to 3 feet of duff in places was that a tree would escape the fire entirely. But the fire would come along and smoke into the duff and burn out the root system and the tree would fall over. And we were really concerned about the trees around the village. So as soon as they burned out the fine fuels off the fire line, we released those scripts and they went around and cooled and wet down the soil to protect the roots. So that was a pretty use for it. So really, I mean, we never had the flame, because of the good fire management, we never had the flame front hit the village hard. So they have not, the scripts are not contested in that way. But it did, I mean, the difference, you notice the difference between the humidity and the temperature was substantial and kept the area very as wet as we needed to actually wetter than we actually needed it. So we had to back off in the spring. There's been a few other things we've discovered throughout that event that, you know, are like the vents is one of them. The skirting around the buildings is another thing we've had a list for a while to work on, but it kind of emphasized the importance of that. And then the diversion structure that feeds all the water, the sprinklers, we want to do a replacement of that to make that more fire than it is now. So, you know, those are probably the next things we're going to do as far as hardening the village for fire.
I guess, you know, the other thing is it allowed you to actually be here. I mean, they wouldn't have made the decision to let anybody be, even the hot shots, or you would probably be in this position had that sprinkler not. And I would imagine there's at least the potential, I mean, for stopping and spotting spot fires or embers. You know, if you can keep a place wet long enough, you're not quite so worried about flaming embers coming and starting something on the interior.
That's a great point, because I think, you know, people, I mean, like, you know, you said earlier, like, do not put people at risk, you know, for structures and hold the support of that. We didn't want it to be a risk for the sake of the village. But the fact that holding it down 20 years of work of metal roofs, we had a lot of defensible space around the village, way more than it used to be, the sprinklers, and then our safety zone, the tins across there, you know, they looked at it and said, yeah, that's a place. They don't often put a fire crew in with their only escape route cut off by the fire. That's not something that they generally ever do. So they are very confident that this is a place they can defend and survive in. So I think that's what holding larger hole over the last couple decades has done is provide a defensible place.
Speaking of risk management, I don't want to ignore the fact that three people lost their lives. Can you talk more about that? Were they all in the same area?
Yeah, that was a tragedy that really was the right after the basically the first day of the Twist River fire. It was called the fire was called in, and you've seen the sort of the context. There was an awful lot going on at the time, but this fire was called up. It was in an area up a valley where there were a lot of cabins and, you know, very much more wildland urban interface. And so, you know, they got on the radio and found some of the local folks who were available to go out and do a sort of a rapid assessment and to, you know, get a hold of people, get them out of there and stuff. And this was, I'm not sure the precise assignment these guys had, but these guys were part of a 2 or 3 vehicle team that went up this one road and then they were kind of retreating ahead of the fire front. I mean, it was a very hot, windy day, and that fire took off very quickly, turned into a really bad front, and there was sort of combination of a vehicle accident. I don't know if anybody knows exactly what caused it, but anyway, this one vehicle ended up off the road, and they got stuck and basically they deployed their shelters, but in some cases it wasn't enough.
Yeah. You showed us some very excellent drought forecast. Maybe there were records in a forecast. But what is the outlook over the next couple of years for drought in this area, and what are the critical spaces within this draw, this valley here, that you would especially keep an eye on, either for Holden or through the U.S. Forest Service, over this next intervening period, and knowing that another fire is going to come?
I think a couple of things. I mean, one is not to get complacent, because one fire does not create a low severity fire regime area. So, you know, I think, in terms of, you know, I don't think anybody knows what the weather's going to be more than, or, you know, when droughts are going to happen more than a year or two in advance. I mean, we've probably got another year before we would be back in a 2014 situation. We've had a couple of good winters in a row. You know, cross your fingers, but But again, every year we have conditions we can burn, so it's you know, it's just a matter, it's a probable, our odds are better for the next year or two, but that can change, you know, all it takes is a month of really hot, dry weather, and, you know, kind of all bets are off. You can certainly burn anywhere this time of year. In terms of the valley itself, I think you have to look, and I would imagine the folks are doing that now, you know, what was accomplished by the fire, you know, where was a good fire, where was a bad fire, where could we, you know, where are the opportunities to reinforce the good stuff. You know, we now have, there was a lot of work put into, you know, fuels management around the village. You know, how could you build on that? How could you maintain, either build on it or maintain it so that you have that area around the village that's in pretty good shape, either not necessarily to stop a wildfire, but to allow like a future burnout operation to happen on fairly short notice. And so, and I haven't heard anybody talking about doing prescribed fire up here, but you know, there's some serious problems with that. But I mean, you could start thinking in those terms of how, either that or, you know, through guest volunteers, maybe we go out and, you know, start have, you know, every summer we're gonna have the big fuel collection project and see how big of a pile we can make out in the middle of the old tailings piles, and you know, have a huge village bonfire, and everybody contributes. You know, I don't know what would be.
Do Burning Man festival?
Yeah, you know, there we go. Burning Man, yes. So I mean, I think there's some things of saying, okay, where did the fire make progress toward, you know, a positive thing toward future fire behavior, and then where is it negative? And long term, I think you have to look at the lower valley and what it's going to come back as. You know, and I think that area down around Dan's camp is one that I'm personally the most interested in, because I think that's the gateway to Railroad Creek Valley and Holden. And personally, I'd much rather be able to defend down there than up here. And so, you know, now that, and that area burned pretty hot, and so, I mean, there's a very defensible area now. How can we have that come back to the kind of vegetation that would allow us long term to at least deter fire from coming up in a bad way, you know, and it depends. If it comes back as a, you know, beautiful flower fields, that's probably okay. You know, if it comes back as pine, you know, big, you know, if we can make it come back as a big pine forest, that'd probably be okay. If it's a huge ceanothus field, for, you know, that could be 20 years of really severe potential fire activity. And so I think that'll be one of the questions as to, you know, that area, the lower 3 or 4 miles of the valley, what's that going to look like? Because that's the most heavily impacted right now. The rest, you know, the part up here around the village, thankfully, we have kind of the same situation we had before the fire. We got rid of some fuels, we've got, you know, but we've replaced them with some dead trees that'll come down and replace those fuels. But it really is about keeping fire, either keeping it away or making sure that it arrives in a condition where we can deal with it. I don't have a great answer. Any other plans that anybody's heard of? I'm sure that's still, you know, nothing
any
works fast.
Plans to do selective planting?
Pardon?
Any plans to do selective planting?
There's already been some planting done. I know Pete Rears had crews up here. I don't know if that was just on the tailings or I think they're waiting another year or two on some parts to see what kind of natural regeneration they get. Our crews have been actually collecting, counting seedlings and stuff to try to figure out what's coming back where. So I'm guessing that'll be another year or two before anybody makes any hard decisions about whether we need to plant some of those severely burned areas. Travis?
So as we have more severe fire seasons like 2014 and 2015, which is costing us a lot more money, have you seen a change in funding for the types of research projects that you're doing to understand those complexes more, or is it pretty even keel? I mean, is there any mentality within, hey, we need to understand this more so we can fight it more effectively, or?
Well, yeah. I'd like to say, yeah, they should send more money to research. But I think the biggest, the very biggest issue right now is, and yes, we could always get better at doing stuff, and I'm all for management studies and stuff that look at what we do and how effective it is, and maybe figure out ways to make them better. I mean, that's my job, and I'm always happy to help. But I think we know a lot about what to do. You know, I think you could take, you know, the fire guys in Chelan, and they know pretty much what to do. They've got 98% of it figured out,
you know, and they could probably do better, but the biggest problem is, you know, do they have a budget to do it? Can they get through the planning process to do it before the fire burns it up? And you know, will and this whole idea of you may have heard of fire transfers or fire borrow, I mean, the idea is that suppression still kind of eats our lunch a lot of the time, and so you may have a project plan and a bunch of funding, but it may take an extra 2 or 3 years to get done because there's a bad fire season. We have to put all that money into firefighters to protect assets at risk. So I think that's, you know, we can do a lot. We know enough to do a lot, and we can always do better. But I think that's the biggest thing right now. It's just, can we figure out, and there's been some talks about like separating fire out from, I mean, right, you know, people joke about we're the National Fire Service now instead of the Forest Service because more than half our money goes to fire. There have been plans on how to pull that out or how to deal with that under FEMA, for example, that wildfire could be under FEMA, and so where you kind of budgetarily separate things out so you can let forest restoration projects and fuel reduction projects go and make them not at the whim of actual fires. They have a hard time getting through the legislative process. Any of you guys have more comments?
I'm wondering if the burning up on Mountain Ridge, on Martin Ridge, puts us at any increased avalanche danger.
I would just say, you know, there's always, I don't know about the snow avalanche so much as more likely mudslide type action would be my concern. Mark?
Well, we looked at that with Baritone afterwards, and actually independent soils. And if you look, the only shoot-related threat to the village itself is the one right here behind the village, and interestingly enough, if you look at where it burned, there wasn't any burn in the starting zone of that avalanche shoot. It didn't burn up there. In the track, it burned up on the sides of the cliffs, but it didn't have an effect on it. The only area that sort of avalanche catchment area that funneled snow into there was the runout zone down where there was a lot of avalanche alder and stuff like that that did burn. And that's come back pretty rapidly. So they're kind of the assessment of the guys who looked at that was like not a significant increase in avalanche danger. It's more sort of what Jamie's talking about with the debris flows in the water, kind of sort of effects on the road itself rather than in the village with the avalanche. Never say never, but.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it would make a major impact on snow. It'd be those runoff events. But that's been an ongoing risk. I mean, there have been every 10 years, it seems like there's, you know, some little mudslide that fills a chalet basement. I mean, it's happened before that they've come down between the buildings every now and then because there's a really bad fall storm or some rain on snow event or something.
Mark's the guy who started the Wenatchee Fire?
They did. Troubled person. You know, was just the equivalent of playing with matches along the side of a road. But you know, it was a very personal fire for us because, you know, it was right across the valley from my sister-in-law's house, and so we spent the Sunday afternoon watching 30 fire trucks fighting it going through this one subdivision, and then. Right about, and we actually had dinner, you know, barbecue at our house because they didn't want to watch it. They were afraid it was going to come that way. And then, as the barbecue, but then as it got up, I mean, they successfully stopped all the, I mean, they protected all the houses very well. But what maybe didn't occur to them, or you know, what also happened at the same time, is they created a really long fire front going up and down this mountain. And when the late afternoon, evening winds came down valley, that became a wall. So it was a narrow, tall fire for a long time, and then it became a very broad fire that just sort of swept swept with the west winds eastward and hit the end of town with a lot of heat.
Did the co-op ever find a place to store all the apples?
I don't know. No, but that was a pretty freaky evening because not only did we see, you know, the neighborhood quarter mile or half mile away from us burn, but then, you know, then we go to my parents' house and we're looking downtown. It looked from their house like half of downtown was burning, and that was actually built big apple warehouses in downtown when a major cardboard recycler that had left all their cardboard. You know, think about acres of pallets of dry cardboard sitting in 100-degree heat. So that was a pretty big fire.
Mark, did anything in the village catch on fire? Anything at all?
Nope. The only thing, my folks lost one plastic outhouse on the road, and then the 10-mile platform by 10-mile falls overlook is burned. But that's going to be rebuilt this late summer, early fall. But nothing in the village itself. Including a few things we kind of wish had on the land. Didn't get a chance.
All right, yeah.
How, I heard there's this trail around the village to prevent the fire. How wide is it and how far away from the village is it?
Well, it's kind of like a narrow dirt road that goes around the village. It's a couple hundred feet outside of the chalet circle. So it's not very far out. You know, it's the fire road. It gives good access. It is sort of a fire line, if you will. But, you know, in certain places, it's also had a lot of trees growing over it. So, I mean, it has its limitations as to how it can function. But, you know, if you're trying to start a burnout operation and you want some bare soil, it's pretty good. Serves that purpose pretty well.
As a Lutheran, it's been an hour and 15 minutes.
Yes. So.
Thank you.
Go in peace.